Hello, this is Deborah Anderson, the Black Woman Animator, coming back to you with another video. And in this video, I have Eric Ramsey. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, thank you for being here.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Eric Ramsey, a native of LA. I was born here. Started at animating when I was in high school. Just made a short film for myself. Took 2 years to complete. 5 minutes of animation. Did it all on a little plastic peg strip taped to a watercolor block. And I worked on like some 12-field paper. The first actual animation that I'd ever done. And I would test it at a place called Duck Soup in Santa Monica. I live in South Central. So it would take me 2 hours to get to Santa Monica to test the animation.
That's pretty
like 150, 200 pages at a time. And that's where it all started.
So for posterity purposes, I have to first start with when I met you and my internal dialogue of everything that went on when I met you. So
let's hear it.
We met at the Great Day in Animation photo shoot. And so like I'm going around and like trying to meet all the people. And I think it was like Everett Downing that was like next to you, and he's like, because I interviewed him already, so he's like, oh yeah, you know, she interviews people, blah, blah, blah.
And
so
yeah, Everett Downing like, is an animator who I met at DreamWorks Animation.
Nice. So I'm talking to you and, you know, chatting it up, and then I already asked you, like, would you be willing to be interviewed, and I get your contact information. So I've already established that your name is Eric Ramsey, but at that point, it was like, your name was John Smith. It was like,
right,
okay, Eric Ramsey, cool. Got your contact information. So we're talking, right? And then you're like, see your brother. And then you're like, oh, this always happens. We're like, we end up dressing alike.
That's right. We were dressed exactly the same.
And so, like, I'm like, kind of trying to like, just kind of like talk to you. So I'm like, you mentioned your brother, but I didn't look or anything or try to figure out who it was. So I'm like, okay, cool. And then like we're talking, and then you kind of mention him again, and then I think you point, and then I look over and I'm like, Peter, oh, like, oh, you're Eric. I'm like, and then I'm like, wait, like you're on my list too, like not just your brother, but you, like I want to interview to you too.
Yeah, you said so, yeah.
And so I just was like, totally didn't grasp the last name part, and like. But what made it worse was, like, we're still talking, right? And then Ron Myrick walks up, and then he's like, are you Peter Ramsey? And I'm like, okay, they don't look that much alike. Like, why are you throwing it in my face that I did not know this is Peter Ramsey's brother? I'm like, I just felt like that was like a slap in the face. Like, really, Deborah, like, you didn't make the connection that he, like, was like, are you Peter? I'm like, they do not look that much alike. Were you?
No, he does. You know, we sound more alike than we look. Like,
yeah, so I just
bear kind of a resemblance, though.
That was like the whole thing that was going on internally when I like first met you, where I was like, and then I'm like, really, really, and so.
That's so funny. That is so funny.
I just think that is hilarious. So, where are you from, and how is it growing up?
I'm from South Central LA, around the Crenshaw and Slauson area. Grew up in the 70s. I was born in 64. And you know, my father's a mailman. My mom volunteered at the elementary school that we all went to. And life growing up was, you know, I had a good time, you know. It was terrific for me, because you know, both our parents were very present in our growing up and in our lives, you know.
Yeah.
Dad would come home from work, you know, driving home, and we'd be in the street maybe playing ball when we were kids. And before he went inside, he would take off his postman's sweater, put it on the top of his car, and we'd play back and forth until it was dinner time. So that was Dad. And even when we got inside, when it was dinner time, we liked to play like some nice music, you know, so it was like some Rachmaninoff or some
nice.
You know, some Miles Davis or something like that. We just listened to music while we ate, and it was just a great times, you know. All of my siblings were very close, you know, so life was terrific. growing up, you know.
How many siblings do you have?
I have two brothers and one sister. Cool. There's Peter, you know that one.
Yeah.
My brother David is a musician.
Uh-huh.
And he lives still here in Los Angeles. And mm-hmm. my sister lives in Atlanta. She's part of the Atlanta School Board. She has, I can't remember exactly what her position is, but yeah. She has education.
Nice.
Yeah.
So what is like the cultural makeup of how you grew up? Not necessarily just like ethnicity, but also like what made it unique growing up in South Central? Like what is the culture that you grew up around? Kind of externally and maybe even internally in your home?
Wow, that's a very complex question, because the thing is, Los Angeles, I mean, that part of LA, it is predominantly Black.
Mm-hmm.
But people just did, there was a range of what people were doing professionally and otherwise. Mm-hmm. You had everything from the tough guy in his neighborhood mm-hmm. to the total nerd, you know. Mm-hmm. And again, I mentioned some of the kinds of music that we listen to. A lot of the kids listen to all kinds of different music too, all throughout Los Angeles, mm-hmm. Throughout South Central too.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty diverse in that respect. But people just have varied interests and things like that, you know. I mean, I was able to be an animator in South Central that way, you know. That somehow that culture made me want to do that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's a long question.
I feel like sometimes growing up as a millennial, I feel like, and it depends on where you grew up, but it's like there's this like one way to be Black. But I feel like in recent years, there's like
yes
more ways to be Black.
Yeah, and I that's what I'm trying to express. Is there was a thought that, you know, there's one way to be Black, but there's so many different personalities and
mm-hmm.
personality types, and like I said, people's interests are all over the place, and it's a very interesting place to grow up.
So you mentioned, you know, your dad coming home and playing ball with you all and like listening to music. What are some other like traditions that you enjoyed in your childhood?
Oh, you know, early on, when I was like 9, I remember, and this is kind of answering your question, but I remember walking into the kitchen when my mom was cooking. I could smell the garlic and the beef and the onions and going mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I just thought to myself, it's like, okay, when I'm a grown man, I'm going to move out and mom's not going to be cooking for me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I better learn now. So
right.
I started to watch my mom cook when I was like 9.
Mm-hmm.
And I would make stuff myself, and I just fell in love with cooking as well. So that's kind of a thing I used to do all the time. Like sometimes I would make the dinner, you know. I'd make
nice.
I learned how to make bread, and so I would make pizzas sometimes, you know,
mm-hmm.
things like that, you know. I learned how to make my mom's gumbo, you know, and
clutch.
So, you know, things like that.
So what are your, like, do you have like a signature dish to bring to like friends' houses or?
Not necessarily, like on a special occasion. Like Marlon had a birthday, and I made mm-hmm. a pot gumbo for him. That was terrific. But
mm-hmm.
you know, just I since COVID, I've been spending a lot of time in the kitchen. Yeah.
Have you learned new recipes that are like bomb?
Oh yeah, yeah. Like, you know, I made this. Oh, God. I made this lobster mac and cheese, which was dynamite. The smoked Gouda. It was fantastic.
Oh my gosh.
I learned how to make teriyaki mackerel
mm-hmm.
from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's so much better than what you get elsewhere. So
yeah.
Yeah, various fishes. I love to eat seafood.
Mm-hmm.
I've been eating a lot of oysters lately, you know. But yeah. Yeah, I make a range of stuff, and I'm always looking for something to cook.
Sounds delicious. So you went to like schools in like different environments growing up. What do you feel like are the main differences in your experience in like going to different schools?
Just leaving from Angeles Mesa, where I grew up, where I went to school all through sixth grade,
mm-hmm.
in the Black neighborhood, and then moving. But getting bused to the west side,
Was that like an integration thing, or?
We had a choice to of a number of the schools that we wanted to. It was part of the integration program.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a choice. It wasn't like we were forced, you know.
Okay.
Because later on, I even went to Palisades High School in Pacific Palisades, mm-hmm. which was another experience altogether. It was terrific. And that's mm-hmm. where I met my friend Steve Nevis. Steve Nevis is now a film editor.
Nice.
And he also was really interested in animation when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I met him. But going back, so going from that one environment to this other environment where it's more diverse, you know, there were Asian kids, there were Latino kids, Black kids, White kids,
mm-hmm.
almost in equal numbers. It was kind of unique.
Yeah.
But I learned that, you know, my conditions growing up in South Central weren't that much different than kids on the other side of town, you know.
Yeah.
And the kids themselves were just like me and my friends and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just learned that then, because I had some misgivings, because at that point, I think the only white people I knew were on television, you know, mm-hmm. actors and stuff like that. But when you actually get to know a person, that all just sort of washes away. Once you become friends with a person, you don't see color that way anymore. You know?
Mm-hmm. So can you take us through your like journey in art and animation during your childhood to like adulthood?
I can almost tell you exactly. I mean, Peter and I, when we were little kids, always loved to doodle in my mom's fashion magazines. We would draw over the faces of the models and stuff like that. So it started there. We would just erase boredom.
Mm-hmm.
But we would do like caricatures of each other, you know, trying to make each other crack up, you know. That was a lot of fun when we were little.
Mm-hmm.
But it seriously started for me, and I think probably for Peter too. We were both big fans of the movie King Kong. It was the Marion C. Cooper's 1933 original.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it stands as one of the best movies I've ever seen. It's just incredible. It's super, super efficient. There's no waste in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you all only get new information at every shot. It introduced me to animation because I knew the gorilla wasn't real, but I wanted to find out how they did it.
Right.
And then we started to research when we were kids about animation, and, you know, multi-planing kind of effects with the backgrounds and production illustration. We looked at all the production illustrations by, I think it was Willis O'Brien,
mm-hmm.
who did all the animation. And that was just really inspiring. Also, huge fan of Bugs Bunny and the Brothers cartoons in particular. So knowing that they were both animated in some way, I started to really get interested and taking something inanimate and making it come to life. And I used to take my old textbooks, my big math textbooks, when I got into junior high school or whatever, and did animation on the corner, like little flip books on the corner,
nice.
Characters running or fighting or doing whatever they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just developed a natural sense of rhythm and timing just by doing that. And then, you know, just going to art school, you know, art class in high school, particularly, this is where I met Steve. Now, Steve lived in the Palisades, and his sister went to school with the daughter of a famous animator named Cornelius Cole.
Mm-hmm.
Corny Cole, he's famous, ask any animator. And he kind of took me under his wing when I was in high school. I was 17? I think I was 17 when I met him.
Mm-hmm.
And he had done a sequence for the movie Heavy Metal.
Okay.
And it was this green orb that was floating around through all periods of time and causing violent acts to happen. It started with dinosaurs. And he animated straight ahead,
mm-hmm.
big sheets of 16 filled paper, and he drew with a ballpoint pen. Yeah, you know, no pencil. He would just go straight in with a ballpoint pen and just go away. And
mm-hmm.
I kind of learned a little bit of his style from watching him and seeing how he operated.
Yeah.
And so when I made my film with Steve, it's kind of the way I did it. It was in a looser kind of a way, not so much, you know, anything to do with character design or anything. Because basically all you saw in my film was a hand and what it draws until the end of the film. But it was flowing, it was always moving. So there were no solid backgrounds, there were nothing like that, no cells or anything. It was just animation on paper. Yeah. And that was very much how, Corny worked. Mm-hmm. And Corny's the one who introduced me to the guys at Duck Soup and said, test your animation there once you get like 200 pages or whatever, 200 panels. So I tested at Duck Soup and I've asked the animators for advice. And the only thing that they said to me ever, from the time I started, from my first one till I finished, was just keep going.
Yeah.
Just keep going. And I just kept going. The only thing, the other thing that they said was keep a sketchbook and keep practicing your drawings. You know, because at the time I wasn't very strong of an illustrator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until later I met Mobius and I worked with Mobius at a studio for 4 years. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole other story.
So, you said it will take you like 2 hours to get the Duck Soup. Like, is that on the bus or something?
I was on the bus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So was it like, transfer?
It was fine, you know, because I felt like at the time that I had something. I really felt like, I think I can actually do this, you know. Mm-hmm. The animators are telling me just to continue on, and I'm getting all this encouragement from Corny and some other people. Maybe I have a shot at this thing. Maybe it can just be not just a hobby.
Yeah.
And that's what it turned out to be.
So, like, what did you learn at Mobius?
Well, Mobius, Jean Giraud, who's, you know, famous for doing Arzak and Lieutenant Blueberry, he had worked on Tron with the guy that I ended up working for. Mm-hmm. They shared studio space. And I remember once it was somebody's birthday. This guy named Jeff, and he was turning 27. And I remember we're all sitting there kind of celebrating a little bit, and Jeff goes, oh yeah, man, 27, I'm all decrepit, and my drawings are crap. And then Mobius goes in and he says, don't worry, I was no good until I was 40. So there's something for young people to think about that. It takes a while to develop your talent a lot of times.
Yeah, even like...
Jean Giraud.
Yeah, like, I feel like... So how do you feel at the age you are now? Like, I'm only 35, but like I feel like your 20s is kind of like discovering that nobody knows what they're doing. And then like my 30s have been like just kind of trying to exist as my authentic self. So like, what do you think? Like, you know, when we're 18 or 20 something, we think 40 or something is old. But like, what do you appreciate about each decade of your life?
Oh, well, I think it's funny, in retrospect, when I look back, the further back I go, the less money I had and the less cares in the world that I had, too. It's a weird thing that happens when you start to get up in age and more successful. It's like you have more and more responsibilities. And I just remember when you're young, there's that sense of discovery and just a hope that just really animates you, literally. And I got skin bumps right now just thinking about it.
Maybe
my early 20s, you know, just starting out in animation. I got my first animation job on my 21st birthday. So that was kind of a good sign, a good
omen. Yeah.
And that one was set up by Corny Cole. He knew a production that I could work on it. He called me on that one, so
mm-hmm.
That was terrific. And in my 30s and 40, I was getting more established. I was doing bigger movies. By that time, I'd moved from being an animator to being a storyboard artist.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was, when I was doing animation, my older brother Peter was already doing live-action storyboards.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to me, Eric, you know, you should think about doing storyboards because it's a lot easier. There's a lot less drawings you have to do, which is true.
Right.
And also, the other thing about doing storyboards is Like I said earlier, my drawings weren't the strongest when I started doing animation, even as a professional. I needed a lot of practice. In fact, after work, I would go home and open up a book, a sketchbook, and practice for 2 or 3 more hours every night, right after work. Mm-hmm. So I was just determined to just improve. Where was I going with this? Peter's convinced me to work up some samples and show up to this agency, Storyboards Inc., which I did, and they signed me on. And so I was at the point where I almost started working on the Rover Dangerfield movie. Mm-hmm. And how that happened was Marlon West, who you know, and I at the time were roommates. And we were both working for this guy, Arnie Wong, at Tigerfly, that was the studio it's called. I can't remember how this happened, but I think Marlon got a call because he had some connections too. He got a call from these guys who were doing this Paula Abdul video with the Scat Cat. So they had a bunch of animation, but they weren't happy with all of it. And there were sections of it that they wanted redone. And they would take it to me and Marlon. So me and Marlon reanimated some of these sequences. And once they saw that, they were like, hey, do you guys, you know, Eric, Marlon, are you guys interested in working on Rover Dangerfield? And they actually wanted me to be one of the animators handling the main character, Rover. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. But at the same time, I had been doing a little bit of storyboards on the side.
Yeah.
And I got my first chance to jump on a live action feature. That was Ron Howard's Backdraft. And so I said, I can't pass that up. So that's what I did. Otherwise, I might be, I'd follow the same type of path as Marlon, going from, you know, Hyperion Studios to Disney to God knows what.
Yeah.
But that's how I switched over from doing animation to being a storyboard artist.
Nice. Would you say that your parents were supportive of your artistic interests, like both you and
your big time. Big time. And I think how we developed our artistic sensibilities, all because like I said, my other brother's a musician, so we all are into the arts.
Mm-hmm.
I remember having a let me try to address it real quick. I think the reason why we developed those sensibilities is because of my father's love for music, because he loved jazz, mm-hmm. and he loved classical music, and he loved Aretha Franklin. And O.C. Smith and guys like that, Otis Redding. But we were constantly listening to music. And we loved it all as kids. Everything from Beethoven to Miles Davis to The Clash to you name it. Mm-hmm. We listened to it all. And I think that kind of instilled in something about the arts that we just kind of really loved. Also, when we were little, we had this World Book Encyclopedia.
Yeah.
And I remember a section on painting. And it was a nice big section that you can just go through and look at all these classic paintings, Rembrandt and Degas and all these kinds of things. And the one painting that blew me away, that I couldn't believe was a painting, was John Singer Sargent's painting of Madame X. And I just studied that and studied it and studied it. And again, that living in that environment where that was around us and encouraged, it made us want to just be part of it.
Yeah.
To be part of it. That's a whole other thing, too. I really wanted to be part of the animation and the filmmaking community. It was just so cool, you know. People are in their lives creating fantasies and telling stories and things of that nature. Just to be part of it was just something that I really wanted to do. And I got really interested in photography when I was 16, 15 years old, after seeing Manhattan, Woody Allen's movie, shot by Gordon Wallace, and good Lord. The movie blew me away. So when I graduated from junior high school, as a gift, my parents gave me a 35mm single lens reflex camera, and I shot everything with that. Lots of black and white. I fell in love with black and white photography. And I used some of that knowledge later on in my years. I had a chance to, I bought a Bolex 16mm camera, and then much later on, I bought a Eclair NPR Super 16 camera, And I tested all these different film stocks and seeing what I liked the best. And I got an opportunity to shoot something for the Learning Channel.
Nice.
And that was a great experience. In fact, I think I shot, it was the first series. I did two episodes of the series. And then I did something like 9 more over the past, over the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of part of my background too, was I was really into photography and cinematography in particular. And it just helped out when I started doing storyboards with composition and understanding how things cut together and how the flow, the editorial flow happens, you know.
Yeah, when I went to Rochester Institute of Technology in upstate New York, like our freshman year, they would say, oh yeah, we're better than NYU because, you know, you guys get to touch a camera your first year. Like, you know, NYU doesn't touch a camera until like their sophomore year. And our first year, we actually two semesters, we used Bolex cameras. Mm-hmm. So I have experience using a Bolex. I got my stuff out of storage recently. And I have all the canisters, but a lot of, it's not visible anymore. So I should have like converted it when I was still at school or whatever. But yeah, like splicing all the film and all that stuff, like they gave us that opportunity.
Yeah, I went for a while, right directly after high school, while I was making my animated film, I went to Los Angeles City College. And I had a terrific film department at LACC. And I fell in love with going to the classes every day. I remember falling in love, my first class in the morning, at 8 in the morning, just waking up, was a documentary class, the history of documentary. And it was one of my favorite classes. Mm-hmm. I just adored it. It was amazing. We had a terrific professor.
Mm-hmm.
But he was awesome. At a history of film class with James Ursini, he was the professor. And I remember watching one day a movie, Out of the Past, on DVD. Mm-hmm. And there was a commentary. And Peter and I were listening to watching it. And we were, hey, that voice sounds familiar. And it was our old professor from LACC. But yeah, they had a lot of a lot of hands-on experience. We had our own films, and you just learned a ton just by doing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I love about filmmaking too is the editing process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't say enough about it, how fun it is to. I think Peter told me that Ang Lee, the director, said, "You know, shooting is like shopping, editing is like cooking."
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, and that's exactly what it is. But we used to, even when we were kids, and we just had cassette tape players and stuff like that. We would edit them and like take lines. We would record sound from a movie that we saw, on the television, record it on the tape, and then we would edit to make our own little crazy story.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just making mix cassette tapes.
Yeah, you know, I did that too. Marlon was the king of the mixtape.
Oh yeah, because he DJs.
Yeah, all that stuff, editing, cinematography, illustration, all of it. And even the computer art, it's stuff like that. It's just, it's all just a tool.
Mm-hmm.
It's just about your imagination, how you play it.
Yeah, you were mentioning painting earlier, looking at paintings, and I know like when I go to galleries or whatever, I like stand really close to them because for me as an artist, I was going to become an electrical engineer before I found art. So I have both the analytical and artistic sides of my brain. And so
I only have one half of a brain.
But like, I've never gotten into painting or anything, but I kind of look at paintings very close to see like how like simple it is, because it's just form and like
value.
Sometimes as an artist, I feel like I make things complicated. And so I just like look at it very close to see how easy you can communicate a figure with simple shapes and their brush strokes and stuff like that. So I'm like really interested in.
You know, it's funny. I never ever learned how to paint.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how to paint. I don't. I mean, I've I mean, I've done some keyframes and stuff. I've learned, but it's only been in the past few years that I learned how to think in that manner in terms of form and as opposed to line.
Yeah.
So I don't have any like finished artwork. It's all just my storyboards or whatever I've done in animation. Mm-hmm. I have a couple now that are that I can pass for, but I never learned that the whole thing about seeing things in terms of value and form as opposed to line until recently. But see, I'm 58 years old, and it's like you're always learning something.
Yeah,
always. I remember when we shared offices with Jean with Mobius.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go because we worked not far from Hennessy and Ingalls, big art and architectural bookstore. That was on the 3rd Street Promenade for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
We would go in and, we would typically go in there just to look at the art books. And Mobius was always in the section of the how-to.
Yeah.
How to watercolor, how to draw this, how to do that. It's like, Mobius, you're like one of the artists and designers ever. But he was always constantly learning.
Yeah.
Always constantly learning.
I feel like I do that too because I feel like you can always get a tip like of how to do something.
Oh, yeah. And in every show that I work on, there's always somebody that I learn a ton from. And it might not even be an illustrator or an artist. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a PA, and there's something about their character or how they solve problems in their mind. Like, I never would have thought of that. How the hell? But I always have like a new hero on every show. Sometimes an illustrator, sometimes it's a director. Sometimes, like I said, it's a coordinator or something like that.
Yeah, I feel like even in my own journey, because my specialty is actually 3D modeling. And so learning from one of my mentors where I've been a professional 3D modeler for 10 years, but my natural inclination is to do details. So sometimes I'll start a 3D model, but I'm like going to the detail of something before getting all the form and shape of it. And so now I'm trying to kind of reprogram my brain to like do all form first, because he's like, oh, if you get a studio, they might want something for layout or something like that. So you have to block out everything first. So I'm trying to like reprogram myself to like do everything, get everything situated in the shot, and then go to detail.
Yeah, it's kind of the same way you build sequences when you're doing storyboard. What I tend to do is after I've read the sequence, and it depends on the director, how they want you to work. Sometimes, some directors will just go, well, here's a paragraph, just go for it. And some directors will have a shot list, this is what I want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everything in between about it. But typically what I'll do is I'll find the big shot that's going to remember. Mm-hmm. Find that composition first. Or there's a series of shots that are like that, just big moments in the sequence. Any kind of reverse engineered sequence from there. Build up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the same type of concept. But also, I'm the same way. I sit in and I start to draw. And a lot of times I'm supposed to be doing thumbnails, right? But there's some detail that sometimes they're just fine for the final thing. And to me, they're just preliminary. Just like, oh, I'll just rough this in. But then I find myself like getting really in there. I'm like, Eric, what are you doing? Just make it warm. What's wrong with you? That's it. Yeah, because, I can get, they can get kind of involved. But that's fine. That's fine.
So I typically list out people's, not all the projects that you've worked on, like some highlights, but the idea is like, saying some projects and being like, oh, somebody who looks like me worked on that. So this came from IMDb. So if anything is wrong, just let me know.
Okay.
And these are only highlights. So Home Alone 2, Lost in New York.
I did not work on that.
Dang it.
That's another Eric Ramsey.
Menace to Society.
Menace to Society, yes. In fact, the brothers, the Hughes brothers, they also went to LACC.
Nice.
To study film, yeah.
Apollo 13.
Apollo 13, one of my favorite movies that I've ever worked on.
Why?
Not only am I a space freak, but Ron Howard is just the coolest guy. I mean, Ron Howard is he's exactly what he appears to be. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a meeting, we were bleeding into the after work after 6 o'clock. It was maybe six of us or something, like going over some things. 6 o'clock, he's like, oh guys, it's six. My wife's cooking dinner. I gotta get home. So he was like very much the family guy, you know. He was terrific. I loved working for him. But also, that's where I met James Cameron too, because Digital Domain did all the visual effects for Apollo 13. And I remember working, meeting him, and he was terrific to work with. Mm-hmm. And later on, I went on to do Titanic. He asked me out to do Titanic.
Yes, that was the next one I was going to mention. Thank you. And then Godzilla. Mm-hmm. How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
The Grinch, yeah. Yeah.
Stuart Little 2.
Stuart Little 2, yeah. I remember doing that.
Looney Tunes Back in Action.
Yes.
Catwoman.
Yeah.
Blood Diamond.
What's that? Blood Diamond, yeah.
Iron Man.
Iron Man.
And Iron Man 2. Green Lantern.
Yes.
Penguins of Madagascar.
Yeah.
Sausage Party.
I did Sausage Party.
How interesting was that to work on?
You know what? I thought it was funny.
I was like, I have to watch this movie. And then the ending is just like, ooh, okay. What?
I know. But it was, you know, it was fun. You know, Seth Rogen's out of his mind.
Yes.
You know, there's a couple other guys that I knew who were working on the movie. And yeah, they're all, very talented.
Like, yeah. And then A Wrinkle in Time.
A Wrinkle in Time, yes. With the great Ava DuVernay.
Yes. How was it working under a black female director? Like,
it was amazing. Mm-hmm. She was like, she could have commanded any army anywhere. She was so together. Mm-hmm. She was very, she took command, you know, and mm-hmm. she's very smart. She let everybody do their own thing. She would have these brainstorming meetings where we would sit around as a group and talk about how to tackle one problem or another. But she was terrific. I loved working for Ava. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Lego Movie 2, the second part.
Yeah.
Pokemon Detective Pikachu.
Yes, that was a lot of fun because I knew nothing about Pokemon before I started. And then I was like, I kind of like these little Pokemon.
You're cute.
They're cute. And it was just a lot of fun, you know. That was with Rob Letterman. He directed it. And mm-hmm. he also directed a movie that I did, Gulliver's Travels. Mm-hmm. That's when I first met him, so.
And then the 2019 Aladdin.
Yeah, I did a sequel for Aladdin. Yeah, that's right. I did. I forgot about that.
And then the 2019 Lady and the Tramp.
Lady and the Tramp, yeah.
That is, might be wrong. That's 2020 Sonic the Hedgehog?
The what?
2020 Sonic the Hedgehog?
No, did not work on that.
Okay.
Not me.
And then the last, like, anything else noteworthy that you worked on that you would want to mention?
Oh, God. There probably is, but I just can't think of it immediately.
It's too many. Too much. Too illustrious of a career. What do you love about animation and storyboarding?
Well, the drawings. I love to draw. You know, mm-hmm. that's one. You know, but again, it's drawing for an end. You know, to solve problems. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, one of the things that I love about storyboarding a lot is the problem solving. How do I actually practically do this? That a real camera can shoot it.
Yeah.
So I'm not a huge fan of, like, the flying cameras all around the place. Although it does have its place from time to time. Mm-hmm. But in general terms, I only like to draw what a practical camera can capture. That's basically my kind of rule of thumb, mostly. But yeah, I love the problem-solving aspects of it. And again, when you're on a film, like Iron Man, especially mm-hmm. the first one, there was that whole discovery that was happening because nothing had been established yet, and we were making everything up from the ground level. Mm-hmm. And working with other illustrators and with the directors and stuff like that, or with John Favreau, it was just really exciting and fresh and new.
Yeah. So. And like with the kind of quote you mentioned earlier of like grocery shopping versus like cooking, mm-hmm. There's a realization of, for me, where each person on a production is like has control of how they see the movie, kind of, and like there's just multiple interpretations. So like the writers write their version, then you storyboard your version, and then you edit, and then you animate or shoot, and it's like everybody has control of how they see it, and it all comes together under the director.
Yes. Yeah, it's a terrific process, I think, because like, you do have a lot of hands on the material. Mm-hmm. But if the script is strong enough, then it all coheres really, really nicely. Yeah, and like I said, the problem-solving things is you try to, when you're doing storyboards, mm-hmm. you try to, with every new shot, you want new information. Mm-hmm. Be retreading over old stuff. There's the point of it is to move it forward.
Yeah.
You know, you only cut when you have to, you know. Mm-hmm. And you usually cut to emphasize the subtext.
Yeah.
You know, for the emotional bit. And it gets really powerful when you start to employ that stuff, even in your storyboards. So when you're storyboarding, you have to keep in mind how it's going to be edited, how it's going to be shot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, acted as well. A lot of the times you're like, and that goes back to my days as an animator, having to add in performance, mm-hmm. characters. And it's one thing that I learned when I worked on The Grinch. I worked on, there was a guy, Tom McGrath, and he was one of the, he directed, I think, some Ren and Stimpy episodes. Mm-hmm. He went on to direct Boss Baby, and he did Madagascar, stuff like mm-hmm. that. But he was on The Grinch as well. And seeing this animation guy, there were two animation guys, him and this guy named Bob Kim. And seeing mm-hmm. the animation guy's storyboard, it was different than how we did it in live action, because
that was actually one of my questions.
As story animators in animation, a story artist in animation, they actually had a little bit more, they were used to having a little bit more leeway in terms of what the script says. They would go on tangents and invent characters to highlight other things that I didn't even think of doing before. Mm-hmm. And I also noticed that a lot of times when you're doing a sequence in a live action for a movie, like an action movie, it's mostly just the action. And there's not a whole lot of, and there can be, but not all the times, there's a lot of character interactions in certain ways. And in animation, I noticed that every sequence that the animators would do was its own self-contained story in itself, had a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm-hmm. Whereas in most action movies and live action, you're just doing the action bits, you know, or all the complicated stuff, you know, the mm-hmm. you know, the spaceship launch or whatever, things of that nature, the stampede or, you know, the shootout. But even looking back at how story artists work in animation, when I went back to doing live action, I started to use that thought process doing live action. And it just made the sequences so much better because they were complete. You know, you can watch the whole thing and understand it. But also what you learn on how to interpret the screenplay, how to tell the story. I learned a lot from watching animation people while I worked. Yeah, I learned a lot. I was at DreamWorks Animation for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And this is like, you know, after doing storyboards for like, you know, 20 something years.
Yeah.
It was basically returning back to where my roots were in animation. And I learned so much about story and character from working in DreamWorks Animation. It was huge, massive.
So from someone who like grew up liking and loving animation, but then getting into like live action storyboarding, like there was a time, well, it kind of still exists, but there was a time when like animation was not respected by live action people.
I don't know exactly that. I think it wasn't that like way for me, you know.
Okay.
Because like I said, I grew up with, you know, animation. But I found like the honestly, story art in animation to me is more demanding than drawing live action to me. Because of all those other reasons that I just about how to develop a character and how do you represent them, and you know, performance aspects of the game and everything like that too. I'll tell you something though, it's funny. Sometimes when I'm stuck doing something in live action, and I'm not sure how to get this character out of a jam. I've come up with this stuff now. I'm not sure how to resolve it or how to even start sometimes. Mm-hmm. One of the resources that I always go back to, and it's a true story, is Warner Brothers Animation. But how would Bugs Bunny get out of this? And then I'd figure something out, sort of like typical of that, that's doable in live action, that Bugs Bunny would have thought of. Or how does the bad guys, you know, thwart himself?
Yeah.
Well, let me study Yosemite Sam. You know, he's great at that. But yeah, a lot of my inspiration still comes from animation. Animated
shorts. How did you meet Marlon?
Marlon came for an interview at Tigerfly back in 1998. Mm-hmm. Typically, you know, the boss was out to lunch, and he'd scheduled this lunch meeting with Marlon to meet him. And I'm like, hey, man, Arnie's not here. He's probably gone to lunch. He'll be back in like an hour, probably, I'm guessing, you know, before to come back or something like that. And Marlon's like, good. And then he noticed on the radio, I was playing, I think it was The Clash or the Cocteau Twins or something like that. And he was like, oh, are you a fan? I'm like, oh man, I love this stuff. And then we started talking about music, and we started talking about jazz a little bit. I'm like, holy shit, this guy knows his stuff. I go, well, man, it might be an hour or more before Arnie gets here. Do you want to just go and have lunch? Because I haven't eaten. And then maybe by the time we get back, Arnie will be here. So we had lunch, chatted all throughout lunch, came back. Boss was there. Marlon got a gig, and we were best friends ever since. In fact, maybe 7 or 8 months later, we were roommates, and we stayed roommates for like 8 years. Yeah.
Nice. Good times.
Yeah.
What have you learned throughout your life and career that would be beneficial advice to others?
Believe in yourself, and don't quit. Do not quit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's those are two key things, you know. You have to have confidence in yourself. Even, you know, you're going to suck when you start. You know, that's just what it is, you know. But if you stick with it, you'll learn the ropes. You'll improve.
You know? Yeah.
But you have to have faith in yourself.
It was so interesting, like, being in these various, Black animation Facebook groups. And I remember, I pay attention to posts, I may not comment or post myself, but I remember this young guy a couple years ago, he had made one post where he was like, I think I'm gonna like move out to LA and quit and like all that stuff, da, da, da. And then like 6 months later, he's like posting that he got a job. It's like, yes, don't quit. Yeah. Don't quit.
No, you have to take a risk. You know, yeah. Take a chance, you know. And again, you know, my parents encouraged us to follow our desires and stuff like that. But also they were like, but you guys are going to school. you're not going to just be bums and just you can get away with it. No way. You're going to school. You're going to get good grades too. Yeah. Either that or go out and get a job.
Right.
Or both.
Your choice.
Yeah.
So You were nominated for an Actors or Art Directors Guild for Excellence in Production Design Award in Fantasy Film for your work on Iron Man. Like, how does it feel to be recognized for your work?
I don't think that was directed at me specifically. I think it was like the whole overall the department. Like,
okay.
But just to be part of that, it was so magical, especially on that first one.
Mm-hmm.
The Age of Discovery and all that kind of stuff. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of, and we did have, I think the visual effects supervisor mentioned, and I think it was one of the, I think it was, one of the science fiction special effects magazines. I can't remember what it was called. Anyway, mm-hmm. He mentioned that. He says, we have the New York Yankees of storyboard artists on Iron Man. And I thought that was a pretty funny quote. Pretty good quote.
Nice. How has the representation of Black artists changed since you first started working in the industry?
That's a difficult question because, you know, I never felt or seen much of any type of racism or anything like that doing what we do. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a bit of super talented Black storyboard artists.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an interesting question because there are more Black people in animation now than there mm-hmm. ever was. When I started, I think I'd known like four or five
mm-hmm.
That I figured, okay, this is all of us. But, but today there's a lot more. And that's because, you know, just our experiences, not just being animators, but a lot of us come to be directors and producers and writers and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And we have a voice finally. You know,
yeah.
I think that's the major difference.
Yeah.
It's just going to become more diverse. And speaking of diversity too, there's not a whole lot of women storyboard artists. They're mm-hmm. out there, but there's not a whole lot. However, in animation, there's tons, you know. It's much more diverse in that respect.
Yeah.
Which I thought was terrific, you know.
I wonder, because I know with interviewing a lot of people, there is a lot of people who, like at least the men, where they're like, yeah, I originally wanted to be an animator, but then I became a storyboard artist. And so, like, why is that not the path for women? Who knows?
Yeah, there's all kinds of different reasons. I mean, I remember meeting lots of guys who are super, super talented, going, oh my God, I can draw circles around. But they had a bad attitude or something like that. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things happen.
Yeah.
Know? I'm not talking black artists, just
right.
in general.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, no wonder you're not getting work. No one likes to work for a jerk, you know?
Right. So, both you and your brother have like 342 in your like usernames. Is this like a secret thing, or like what is the 342?
We have a friend Vincent. You know, he's passed away since, so
mm-hmm.
He used to work in Northrop, and he used to get off of work at 3:42. I'm like, well, why not 3:45 or 3:00 or 3:30? Why 3:42? But we just thought that was a strange number that we use that number sometimes. And this is
what's the guy's name again? What's the guy's name?
His name was Vincent.
Okay.
And he also was a gifted artist, self-taught. Mm-hmm. He drew a lot like Neil Adams. He was really super talented at a very young age. He just had a better understanding of it than most people do. Yeah.
I like that little inside joke. What is the Carnivore Club?
Oh God, Marlon. Okay, there's like 12 of us now. Start it off with five.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Newsom is a storyboard artist. Andrew Bluestein, film editor. Steve Nevis, editor. Marlon and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And we started meeting at Musso and Frank's once a month. And we've been doing that for the past, since 1992, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we're the staff there knows who we are.
What's the idea behind it?
It's a thing to stay in touch with friends who you may have drifted away from otherwise. Because you know how this town is. It can be hard to stay in touch for long periods of time because you meet so many people. And people don't understand it. It's nothing sinister that you fall out of, that you don't hang out with the friends like you used to. There's just so much going on, you know, that sometimes it's just impossible that your careers are not always going to go traveling a parallel sort of path, you know, it doesn't work that way. But this is a great chance for us to all get together and stay together.
Yeah, even though I've only been here like almost two and a half years, I've experienced that we need to get together. And for, with some people, it's like, okay. like you've said this about 6 to 8 times already, and I'm just like, let me know.
Well, the thing too is like, back in the early 80s, when Marlon came out, because he came out from Chicago, he was amongst a bunch of guys who had studied at Columbia College in Chicago, who moved to California, to LA, to get involved in the film business. And for years, they were just a super tight crew and just a really, really good friends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we, you know, Marlon loves to throw a party. So like twice a year, you know, we do his birthday party, which is in April, a Funk Bash. Mm-hmm. And we'd either do a Halloween party and or a sort of a holiday sort of Christmas time party, which is always fun. I love the Halloween ones because people showed up dressed in costumes. And some of the costumes were so inventive and so fun. There was one of our friend John, I remember, he was dressed in all black and he had little dinosaurs pinned to him. I'm like, well, what are you? He goes, I'm the Brea Tar Pits. It was stuff like that. There was a guy who came as Dr. Strangelove, totally in like a wheelchair and everything. Uh-huh. People went all out. It's a lot of fun. Tons of fun.
I think also like, even if you don't necessarily become friends with people, but you're their coworker, like a lot of people are like passing ships. So sometimes when I come up, when I interview somebody and like somebody they worked with watches the interview, they're like, I've known this person for 20 years and I never knew that.
That's funny. That's totally funny. But yeah, you just never know.
Yeah. So you said that you were in a band.
Talk about a band. Oh,
Talk
yeah.
Talk about that. You played the bass.
I played the bass with my brother, David. We were called the Treehouse. And I think they had to change that name for some reason. But we played together for maybe 2 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it was just, I remember starting, because it was my first band. David had been in bands before. And I started playing with them. And I remember the first maybe 3 months, we were just terrible, you know. But again, it goes back to not quitting. We just kept practicing 3 times a week. And we just got tighter and tighter and tighter. And once you form that bond, that become a unit like that, a cohesive unit, it's just intoxicating. I can't even describe it. Going to rehearsal, I would rather do nothing else than go to rehearsal. Nothing. It was the best. It's like Nirvana. Mm-hmm. Especially when you start clicking on all cylinders. It's just so fun. It's just so fun. And it's the truth, man. It's so funny. I remember we played a gig in Santa Barbara, like our very first gig. And we showed up to this big party, Isla Vista, college town. Mm-hmm. And we're in the bedroom. We were getting ready to go, you know. And there were some cute girls. And we're like, oh, let's try to talk to them. And they just had none of them. Okay. I'm like, oh, okay, well, whatever. I'm too nervous to talk anyway. We got to play. So we get up and play. After we finish playing, those same girls were like little butterflies all around you. It's so crazy. It's so crazy.
So that's the power of a musician.
I suppose so.
So, like, as a veteran in the industry, like, what have you decided is your kind of purpose in, like, bringing up other people in the industry? Do you, like, mentor or or do you just like, is there anything that you kind of concentrate on with like maybe trying to get more people in the industry?
You know, not I haven't done a whole lot of that. I need to, you know, give talks to kids and things like that. But no, just encouraging kids that, you know, again, finding, even if it's not animation or in the arts, you know, find something that you love to do and stick with it. Because too many people in this world, I think, are just miserable because they're stuck doing stuff that they just really would rather not be doing, you know?
Yeah.
The lucky thing about being, working in our field is that it's something that we grew up loving.
And yeah.
You know, me and we're just, and just to have the privilege to be able to do that, it's really amazing. But whatever it is you love to do, like I have a nephew, and he's really tall, very athletically built, and he's a great basketball player. All of a sudden, he stopped going to basketball rehearsal. And then he lied to his mom about going. He said, no, mom, I'm going. But he wasn't. The coach would come over the house and go, Andrew has not been coming to basketball practice. What's his deal? Everybody got real concerned.
Mm-hmm.
What they found out was happening was instead of going to basketball practice, he'd go to the library and he was studying engineering and mathematics and stuff like that. That was his passion.
Mm-hmm.
And then once that was discovered, it was like, oh, we should just told us the truth, man. And that's where his passion is. And he's just excelling at it right now. And
nice.
He's really, really happy with it. So that's the thing. Some people it's being a musician, being an artist, but some people it's being an engineer.
I feel like the logic of kids can be interesting. It's just like, I can't tell them I'm interested in engineering.
And where did he pick that up? I have no idea. I don't know because his mom's not an engineer. His dad's not an engineer.
No. Kept this like secret of like excellence.
yeah. That's
so, what do you hope for the future of animation as far as like innovation, storylines, characters? Like, what do you hope?
Oh, God. I'm going to see something I've never seen before. everybody says that.
Right.
Oh, God. That's a really difficult question because, you know, all the innovations in terms of like using computers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are afraid of that stuff, but I don't think they ought to be so much,
mm-hmm.
you know, because again, it's just a tool and, you know, it can be learned and mastered by most people.
Mm-hmm.
It's mainly this, that's a tough one. The story, mm-hmm. it's always the story, isn't it?
Yeah.
The characters and finding that right. You know, the right combination. But in terms of for the future of animation, I think it's always going to be viable because, you know, it's you can do things in animation that are still impossible to do or to believe in live action.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an elastic platform. I just hope it doesn't stagnate until so that there's just one style that's fit for everything. And I think you're starting to see things change now. And part of it is because of people's work on the computer too.
Yeah.
Different studios are starting to have different looks, films. I used to get spillover work for a company called Kurtz and Friends. And Bob Kurtz would do these really wild-looking characters, you know, with big eyes, and they had long, spindly legs, and giant feet, and just all these kind of—it was just the most unique, crazy, serious-looking stuff like that. I kind of wish there was more of that.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, there was more of that because I remember also being very much into clay animation,
mm-hmm.
like public television. They would have shows. Anthology shows of these animated short films and clay animation would be most a lot of it. And I just, and again, anything that was animated I love. You know, there's a Canadian filmmaker named Caroline Leaf, I believe her name is. And she used to do this animation on a light box with sand, and she would manipulate sand. So things mm-hmm. And it was just another way of using animation. I really like that application of animation. I wish there was more of that instead of just the mainstream stuff. I wish there was a better, somehow, platform for it or an avenue for it. But all that stuff was just super inspiring. And it just showed you how diverse and how diverse, you know, that the field of animation can be.
Yeah. There's a conversation I was having with one of my friends yesterday that I wonder what your thoughts are. Like, so, you know, sometimes movies today, they'll be like 2 hours long and you're like struggling through it. But I had started in the past couple of years, I started watching like, you know, older movies, like the black and white movies and stuff like that. And sometimes you'll watch some of those movies and they'll be 2 hours as well, but it's like you don't notice because the story is so good. So what do you think is like the difference in like how some people do stories today? Like obviously there's still some good stories today, but like some of the black and white is like, man, they were writing.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because those old pictures, because, you know, amongst those are some of my favorite movies of all times. Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned Out of the Past earlier. That's a Robert Mitchum movie. Kirk Douglas is in that. Jane Greer, fantastic movie. Mm-hmm. The Maltese Falcon is another one that I just watch all the time. It's like watching The Godfather to me. Mm-hmm. But those movies... Just the way they're shot and the way they're made, they're a lot simpler than today's movies. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the credits on those movies, there's a couple dozen people in the credits of those movies from the 40s. Like today, you got 40,000 almost with all the digital artists and stuff.
Yeah.
All the essential people, because it's just a different style of filmmaking.
Yeah.
And I think that's reflected in how the screenplay is written. Because... Yeah, I think those movies were a bit more based on, actually, I was going to say something that was probably untrue. Yeah, it's just the filmmaking styles have evolved throughout the years, too. So that's one way to look at it. But there was, like I said, I mentioned King Kong, how efficient that movie is. There's no wasted frames in that movie. Mm-hmm. It's the same with those movies. They're simpler in the way they're approaching it. There's so, because every time you get new information constantly.
Yeah.
And you're not bombarded with just dazzling visuals at the time.
Yeah.
Although a lot of them are just crazily stunning. You look at Touch of Evil, for instance, or like, you know, Citizen Kane, movies like that. I think I don't know if that's the difference, if that answered your question. That's just my opinion.
Yes, I feel like sometimes, because you know, they film school that you'll never enjoy a film ever again. Which sometimes I could turn it off, and sometimes it just I'll be in the middle of movies like what are they doing? And so sometimes I'm watching a movie and there's like a certain shot, and I was like, why did they do that shot? It served no purpose. Sometimes you could tell a shot was just to do something cool.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't serve the story at all. Like they're just like, I'm gonna do this low shot by this and all this stuff. And it's just like, what was the point? Like I remember watching was it Widows or something like that? Where I can't remember the movie, but it's like there's a shot where the camera is on the hood, like where the ornament would be, the camera was like facing the car,
mm-hmm.
and like for part of the scene, so it might have been Viola Davis or somebody, and two people are talking in the back seat, and they got like a driver. And the camera is pointed towards the passenger side mirror for the conversation. Like, I feel like typically in film, like maybe if you want to do this, what you think is a cool shot, then eventually you go inside to look at the people talking. But they never went inside the car. It was like part of the scene was pointed at the passenger side mirror, and then they did this like pan over to the driver's side mirror, and I'm like, why are we listening to this conversation but looking at the car? Like, what are you doing?
I'd have to see that. That's weird. that's weird. But maybe I don't know. Maybe there's another purpose or something.
Yeah, I was trying to figure it out. I mean, there could be a purpose, but I didn't figure it out.
If it's not clear, then you know it's probably a little bit. You're trying too hard. You know?
Yeah. And then, in the, I would say like late 2000, early 2010s, there was this for my generation. There was this like big like YouTube. TV show, like that's where Issa Rae came from and stuff like that.
Right.
And so something I realized watching a lot of YouTube, you know, movies or TV shows or web series or whatever, was that if your story is tight, the quality could be almost trash. Like
it's everything. Yeah. And character is story. They're one and the same. So if that's tight,
mm-hmm.
then you look at South Park. Look at South Park.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the content is just outrageous. It's funny. And the characters are defined. Mm-hmm. You don't need anything really elaborate to tell that story. It can almost be just a radio play. But that just goes to show how powerful the story is, how important, how almighty the story is.
Yeah.
You know.
So a couple more questions. Hopefully you thought of something. What is a story that you've never gotten to talk about? Or something, some interesting story that has happened that you would like to share?
God. You posed this question to me yesterday and I was supposed to think about it. Oh, God. Yeah, I can't tell you anything embarrassing.
Why not?
Oh, God. Let's go back to that one.
Okay. So if someone was producing a documentary about you, what things would you want them to highlight outside of your work in animation and live action?
Oh, my years as a fashion model, I think. I'm kidding.
I didn't mean to immediately laugh. Like, okay. It would have been horrible if that was true.
It was boasting. I wanted it to be obvious.
I mean, it could have been possible.
If I was to make someone was making a documentary, what would I like to focus on? I don't know. It's hard for me to look back at myself and tell you that question. It's a hard question. I don't know. You're going to make me answer, yes. I'd say, oh God, this is tough.
I mean, it could be, you know, your friendships, your family, kind of hobbies that you had.
I think that's one thing. Maybe it's like I'm always trying to learn something new.
Because
I don't know if you can see behind me, I've got model airplane parts, and you can see my Dremel tool and my square and stuff like that. So I just recently started to play with like woodworking stuff, you know.
Nice.
I find that really fascinating, you know, to be able to actually build something practical.
Yeah.
Just for myself, not for anybody. Mm-hmm. But just to learn something new, you know. And I think that's what keeps me excited. And enthusiastic about getting up every day. You know, there's always something new to learn. I think that's the number one thing for me. It's like,
yeah,
there's always, you know, you've always got to sort of to reach the next plateau, the next mountaintop. You know, find another goal for yourself to conquer. And you know, another thing I like to tell young people looking at the show is, oftentimes you can bite off way more than you can chew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Take the steps that you're pretty sure that you're going to be able to accomplish, and that'll just give you more confidence. It'll get you further along in your goal, and you can take bigger steps once you've mastered some of the other stuff like that. But take your time. Don't be in too much of a rush to want to do everything all at once.
Right.
And you'll get there. But you know, you've got to learn how to crawl before you can run.
I feel like with me originally wanting to be like an electrical engineer because I was really good at math. If I had multiple lifetimes,
I was terrible at math. I was terrible at algebra, but then when I got to geometry, it was easy for me because I was visual. I could see the problems in my head, literally. And I could almost, without working things out on paper, tell you what the answer to.
The shapes. It was the shapes.
It was the shapes and then how they connected to each other and interacted with each other.
Yeah, like I remember being in eighth grade. I think I was in algebra in eighth grade and like, you know, having my protractor and just like drawing angles and then finding the angle with the protractor for fun. Like, so like, if I had like multiple lifetimes, I feel like I would have like been an electrician and like a cabinet maker because I like building things as well. Like, when I was a child, like when my mom would have, you know, furniture, I'm like, I'll put it together. And like, even with like all the furniture in my apartment now, I'm like, yes, I will do it. And
yeah, I'm very much the same way because I remember being a little kid and you know, what toys that we had, I would, you know, we'd play with them to death and they'd break. And I would fix them. I'd put them back together. We had these little slot cars. And after a while, they would burn out. Parts of them would burn out. So we used to take them apart, cannibalize them, and build another. We called them a Frankenstein car. Out of parts of the dead cars. And it would run for another couple of days, and then it would burn out. But it was just fun always building things and putting things together and you know, things of that nature. Again, problem solving. It's just fun to solve problems.
Yeah, well, I would like to thank you for coming on my platform. I told you also when I first met you that you were on my list, but I could, like, I'm Google Queen, Google McGee, but I could not figure out how to contact you.
I know, I'm pretty secretive that way. But I'm on the gram now because I wasn't on Instagram until late last year. So
it was awesome, like me. Okay, like I can get his email now because I just was like, this man is nowhere on the internet.
When there's another art department coordinator, and I was working on a film, and she was looking for people's images online. And she goes, Eric, do you have a life online? You can't find anything on you. And I go, I want to keep it that way. You know, there's no slight to actors or anything like that, but there's no way I'd ever want to be famous. You know, I'll take the my peers loving my stuff and all that kind of stuff. I want that, of course.
Yeah.
You know, and all the stuff that comes, all the trappings that come with, you know, having a good, solid career. But yeah. I don't want to be walking on the street with people like, hey, Eric.
No pictures.
I'm very, very shy, and I'm very personal in that way. Very much to myself, you know.
Yeah.
You know, a public face. I don't really.
Well, thank you for allowing me to highlight you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, terrific. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
So to everyone out there, I want you to like, so I know it's real, comment and tell me how you feel, subscribe to Slittle Deal and sign up for post notifications to show your zeal. And I'll see you in the next video. Peace.